Hello, my name is Lisa Falsko, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it's such a pleasure to see everyone here today. We are really excited about today's program. We have a special group. First, maybe I should recognize all the students. If you are a student, would you mind standing? We are so glad you guys came today. I know we're getting close to the end of the year. Look at that. Love that. And thank you so much to BP for sponsoring our student programs. My folks here on the right, don't sit down, because I see we've got our illustrious WorldQuest winning team join us today. And I want you guys to come on up here. And John Rulin, their coach, and David Ramser, who is on our board, who helped us a lot with our funding. We are so thrilled. If you're not familiar with WorldQuest, it is a student competition that we are part of. You know, Alaska World Affairs Council is one of 95 councils in the United States. And this competition tests students in teams of four on foreign affairs, current events, geography, a lot of really tough questions. A lot of us adults play, and we get skunked by the students. They are really good. They do a lot of preparation. And this team beat out more than 30 other teams, and they're going to Washington, D.C. We're sending them there to compete and represent Alaska, and our Alaskan teams do very well. We are so impressed. They often get in the top 10, top 20, and that's against, you know, the private schools on the East Coast, and Alaska's right there. So we are so thrilled, and we have certificates for all of you, little keepsakes, and we want to hear about your trip and, you know, what you guys do in the future. I'd also like to recognize, speaking of WorldQuest, Sharon Davies, who's in our audience. Sharon, if you wouldn't mind standing, I can't thank you enough. Sharon helped put together and sponsor a video of WorldQuest. And if you would like to see what it looks like, it's available on YouTube. Just Google on YouTube WorldQuest Alaska competition, and you'll see about 6 minutes highlighting exactly what this is. Not only are Alaskans Googling this, but people all over the United States are looking at this video that Sharon helped us make to promote this project and this competition. And the latest is El Paso, Texas is using this to start a program for their students down there. So thank you, Sharon, for making it possible, not only for our students and our community, but for the people in El Paso and all over the United States. And now, if you have noticed, on your table, there are white clickers as well as an orange card underneath that. If someone from the table could grab that, or you could pass it to someone, you can choose however you'd like to be the designated person with the clicker. You can have the best dressed, or the last person, or the sucker, or whoever you want. But if one person can take a clicker, we're going to read a statement, and you can discuss amongst your table mates democratically how you would like to vote as a table on this statement, whether you agree, you're neutral, or you disagree with the statement. And then after the program, we're going to read the statement again and let you vote again after another discussion. So here is the statement, and then I'll give you 2 minutes to discuss amongst the table, and the person with the clicker will then press A for agree, B for neutral, or C for disagree. So the statement is, music and art, more than anything else, are the most impactful means of enacting societal change. So music and art, more than anything else, are the most impactful means of enacting societal change.
Thank you, Lisa. It's indeed my pleasure to be here today to introduce this distinguished panel to talk about this very interesting topic. I don't know what you decided at your table, but we had quite a discussion about that. I don't think any of us have quite considered how fundamental art and music might possibly be in our lives, and especially in the acquisition of justice. So, as Lisa told you, I am the chair of the steering committee for the Defiant Requiem, the Anchorage concert. Yes, please. The Anchorage Concert Chorus is really pleased to partner with the Alaska World Affairs Council to bring this panel to you today. And so now I will introduce Murray Sidlin, who is sitting just to the left of Tori right there. He is, pardon me, he is the conductor of the Defiant Requiem and the founder and creator of the Defiant Requiem, the founder of the Defiant Requiem Foundation, which supports this this performance around the world. Its premiere is going to be tonight in Anchorage at 8 o'clock in the Atwood of the Performing Arts Center. You'll see on your tables that there's some literature from us. If you're interested in getting tickets, you really don't want to miss this. You don't want to miss this. People will be talking about this for years afterwards, and you'll be sorry if you miss it, really. Also, Sunday at 4 p.m., we're going to be having a second performance of the Defiant Requiem, Verdi at Terrazin. Julie Decker, down on the end there, is the CEO and director of the Anchorage Museum at Rasmussen Center. She is leading the museum beyond its recent expansion to position it as a key cultural institution in the international north. She's authored and edited numerous exhibition catalogs and publications on the arts and the architecture in Alaska. George Martinez, sitting just to the right of Julie there, is an award-winning artist, social entrepreneur, and cultural ambassador for the United States Department of State. He is the founder of the Global Block Foundation, the co-author and editor of the Organic Globalizer, hip-hop, political development, and movement culture, and an adjunct professor of political science at Pace University. Our moderator today, of course, is Tori Allen, who is an Alaskan and national arts leader with more than 30 years of wide-ranging experience in the performing arts and broadcast media. He currently serves as the Chief Officer of Marketing and Development for Alaska Public Media. Please join me in welcoming today and discussing music, art, and justice. There's more to the title, there's more. Music, art, and justice, community building, and political expression internationally and locally. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And I just want to take a moment to recognize the Anchorage Concert Chorus for what they've done here. I can tell you, having been in the performing arts for 30 years in New York City and various places around the country, and having been a performer, the way they have super contextualized this production, this event, is just monumental. And the community should be very proud of their work, partnering with the World Affairs Council and other groups in the community to showcase this really super important work. So thank you. It's in all my years in this business, rarely have I seen the kind of super contextualization of a presentation in such a short period of time. It's just magnificent. So I won't take, we'll get right into the meat of things today and ask our panelists a series of questions and see where we go. So Mary, we'll start with you. Why is the Defiant Requiem important today?
Well, let me just give a few sentences that summarize Defiant Requiem, and then we can put it in the context of its relationship to modern society and modern times. Defiant Requiem is the story of prisoners of the concentration camp Terezin, which was located just about an hour from Prague. And in the concentration camp, there was this roundup of Jews from Prague, from other parts of the country that was then Czechoslovakia, portions of Poland, portions of Germany. And it just so happens that there was a rather extraordinarily large community of artists and scholars that coincidentally were thrown into this camp. And professional people as well, not only artists and scholars, but people in a variety of professions, medicine, law, education, and so forth. And these people had not worked outside in their communities since 1939, since the invasion. And so if you were a performer, you didn't perform. If you were in college, you were no longer in college. If you taught, you were removed from the classroom. Jewish life had shut down, so anybody who was Jewish at that time, no matter what profession, was quite limited in what he or she could do. If you were a dentist, you could still work as a dentist, but only on Jewish patients, not on non-Jewish patients. I think you get the picture, and we know a lot about Nazi Germany and what happened during the occupations. So here they are, at any one time in Terezin, as many as 60,000 people in an area that was originally built in 1780 to house 7,000 people. And ultimately, there were 150,000 plus that went through. And so what happened is there exploded in Terezin, first underground and then above ground, a rather extraordinary community of arts and humanities. Ultimately, there turned out to be 2,400 lectures given by 530 prisoners on every conceivable subject. There were about 1,000 concerts given. Concerts meaning choral events, opera and opera scenes, cabaret, which is light music that was always politically more or less, a commentary. And then there were 20 contemporary living, working composers creating new music in Terezin, which certainly was an act of faith, and also it serves as an eyewitness. So I would say the relevance of Terezin today is that they learned the value, the importance, the courageous infusion into their bodies and souls, hope, dignity of the arts and humanities. That they responded to the worst of mankind with the best of mankind. And they did so not knowing what their fates were, but they felt the need to continue living fully and at the best level they could. Now, these were people without any day-to-day nutrition. They had two little cups of gruel a day, nothing nutritious. And then they had very limited medical attention at first, and then none. So with all of this, in the place they were, they chose and reached out for the best of mankind to inspire them and also for future generations to represent them. It kind of reminds me a little of what John Kennedy said when he dedicated the Kennedy Center, or wrote the dedication. It opened in 1970, and of course, he died several years earlier. I shouldn't say died, he was murdered several years earlier. And he said that we will be remembered as a society by what we created, not by what we destroyed. And here's a good case in point. If you look at Nazi Germany in general, we had recognized up through the war the incredible contributions to mankind, to the arts, to sciences, music, and so forth, all the arts, by the German nation. Then they came along, and what they destroyed now outlives in many ways what they created. There's also one more thing, and then I'll pass the baton, and that is that we cannot assume if people are cultured that they are also the good people, the leaders, the people who will inspire the future. We must recall that one of the things the Nazis did is they put together this conference in a place called Wannsee, which is just outside of Berlin, and it was headed by two people, General Heydrich and Colonel Eichmann. And it was their job to put together a group of people to discuss and define what became known at that conference as the final solution, meaning what to do about the Jews. And so at the table, if you go around the table, there's an incredible book called When Learned Men Kill, and I wish I could remember the author and publisher, but I can't. When Learned Men Kill. And it defines the people around the table. Most of them, if not all of them, were men. Not all were military, most of them were. But they were people who were men of letters. They spoke many languages. They wrote, they read, they loved literature, they loved art, they loved music, especially German music, which included Wagner, but it's also Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, so forth. And so these were people who were highly cultured, who defined and developed the methodology for perpetrating the final solution upon the Jews. So there is the dichotomy. What's the importance of terrorism today? Remember it. Remember it. Know what the prisoners did, that in the times of the greatest inhumanity, they reached out for the best of mankind and were inspired by it and acted upon it and remained civilized and cultured throughout the entire concentration camp experience.
So powerful. I have to feel like I have to take a breath after that. Thank you, Murray. Can you hear me okay? Okay, great. So Julie, as someone running one of Alaska's leading art institutions today, how, for you, what makes the Defiant Requiem important today?
Well, I think when people talk about the Defiant Requiem, one of the things they talk about is the that great art has the ability to transcend limited circumstances. So it becomes powerful in its moment of time as a symbol of hope and resilience. So when I think about the Defiant Requiem today, I think about us living in times of great environmental change. This is a time of ISIS. This is a time of cultural politics. It's a political season. We have perpetuating race issues. And so I think sometimes art represents our unbroken spirit, and I think that's a really powerful thing. I also think that it's difficult to talk about art as a collective, because art is a form of expression and it's a form of individual expression. So sometimes we crave making these collective statements about art and artists, but what we know is that they can also elicit fear in a society and in institutions and organizations and political processes, that oftentimes they're mistrusted because they're considered radical rogues or people who might question authority and what we think we know at this time, instead of being a thoughtful part of a conversation. So what I see and what I'm interested in as a director of a museum is that I think artists, the artists that are commenting on the world around them, are influenced by the conversation of our day. They're reflections of everything from discord to hope. And I think that the really powerful art that transcends that is the one that moves beyond a political or a daily discourse and elevates the conversation to one that does feel collective and that does start to make a universal statement. And often that's one not of discord, but of hope and resilience.
Thank you. And George?
I'll be brief about this because I think, for me personally, the language Defiant Requiem is important. And I hadn't known much about it until I kind of seen it in play here in the city and from a little bit of familiar with the work that Murray produced. And what I think about are Negro spirituals. When I think of this. And so I think of the capacity for language and music to do a couple of different things. There's the value of expression, to be able to know that we're alive in dire circumstances, and with our breath we can make something that transcends where we are, and I think that is very relevant today. But I think that it also meets the value of collective survival. The nature of production and the nature of the community that converged, bringing their talents together in a concentration camp in the most dire circumstances, where they already knew there was the plot for Final Solution, and to still transcend collectively to be able to survive even beyond their immediate selves. And it's one of those things that I think of as an organizer. A lot of the work we do will not see the benefits of the work we did. We are passing that on. And when we create music or works of art and they're in these circumstances, I think that what is really powerful is it transcends time in a way that it is so relevant today, it is so relevant for all times, that we can see this in other cultures and we can see it in our own inner cities. And so I think that there's defiant requiems being developed every day in some of the pressure cooker places in our world, and it might be different. They might be creatively new to maybe the styles of yesteryear, but I think that that same power of collective stone soup creation of the space of hope is very important and relevant today.
Thank you. I observed some artists, some of this after the issues in St. Louis, I think a couple of years ago, and I couldn't help but to ask myself, and that is, how can the arts community go beyond reactive responses to social and political crises and develop manageable templates that are affordable and replicable that enable proactive systemic change and systemic political and social change? For instance, what can the artists and what can the artistic community do beforehand to prevent these kinds of crises? Murray?
Oh my. I think it really depends on the strength and conviction of the artist. There are those that feel themselves isolated and work only on the development of art as they know it, as they sense it, and they feel it. I think that, you know, I don't know that many of the great painters of the so-called Impressionist school, not many of them, as I understand it, we're terribly political. I mean, you can't live in a world and not be political if you're dependent upon the freedom of expression. Yes, but specifically political. I mean, I don't know that there were many Guernicas and the kind of statements that are being made. Someone like Beethoven, I do think, was quite proactive. For example, when he learned in 1789 of the French Revolution, the first thing he wanted to do was to move to Paris to be closer to the seat of the revolution. It turns out that he didn't, and it was probably best, knowing what happened with Napoleon after that, it probably was best that he didn't go. But his music from that point on was really symptomatic and symbolic of a phenomenal sense of individual freedom. I mean, he was a huge Democrat, small d. He was a huge Democrat. I mean, and everything he did was unusual and attention getting on the basis of moving away from the status quo. It really shook the musical world. In his second symphony, which we consider to be now a great staple of concert hall beauty, but several critics wrote disparagingly about it, not unusual for contemporary art, but in this way, one critic in particular, a man named Hanslick, who was quite anti-Beethovenistic, he said, "It sounds like a snake writhing in agony, bleeding at the eyes and refusing to die." The beautiful, tame, inspiring Beethoven's Second Symphony. Nowadays we'd say, what's wrong with that critic? But in those days, they had to ask, if Hanslick said this, what's wrong with Beethoven? But something else happened. He came upon the Ode to Joy by Schiller in 1789 and 90, and he made a mental note that someday he's going to do something about this, you know, because of the statement, you know, alle Menschen werden Brüder, all people are brothers and sisters. And he was so impacted by it. Now, he was, by this time, he was just about 19 years old. That's a perfect age to become really politically astute and active and think democratically and all of that. But he never lost it. He never outgrew it. I mean, he never became the top kind of capitalist that says, you know, look, there are people who say that if you're not a communist at 19, you have no heart. If you're not a capitalist at 50, you have no head. I mean, there are people who think that way. But Beethoven never lost his this enduring sense of justice. And he saw it everywhere. When the Ninth Symphony was premiered, for example, in the audience were representatives of seven different armies passing through Vienna on their way to various conflicts. And here he is teaching them. One more thing, and then I'm finished. Beethoven referred to himself as a Töne Dichter, a tone poet, and then immediately said, and the poets are the great teachers of society. Imagine, a composer says, the poets are the great teachers of society, which I think goes to the heart of this question. So the question is, if he considered himself a tone poet and the teachers are the great poets of society, what is Beethoven trying to teach us? In the Ninth Symphony, he makes the first three movements quite disheveled to symbolize the state that the world was in. But in every time he gets to a finale of his works, it's as though he comes back from the grave and says, you know, it's not too late. And here's the way to go. So I think here is a composer who is way out in front, sees the world, knows what we can be, understands the huge gifts that mankind can give to each other and themselves, and I think really was an icon with both a sword and the balm of salvation as well.
Oh, good, thank you. And George, the same question for you.
Well, there are diversity. Obviously, there are differences between different types of artists and where they come from and how they see themselves interacting with the world. I have an activist nature to seeing art and artists, and I think that, first of all, the ability to respond to claims is very much a fundamental component, and we talked about that in the first response, but the idea of, for example, one of our constitutional rights as American citizens is to petition our government for redress of grievances. That's one of those fundamental spaces where art have had a reactionary role to being able to draw up and raise more awareness of those sorts of claims and petitions. But thinking of inside culture, inside art groups themselves, and I'm going to use the urban art forms embedded in the cultural phenomenon as known as hip-hop to give you an example of this, because about 20 years ago I might have said that and there would be people in this room who would not have heard of hip-hop, and that's not true anymore. You might have a divergent difference of opinions, but we've all heard it, and so the level of awareness has grown. And so just consider this. Has anyone in this room ever been to a b-boy or breakdancing competition? Right on, several. If you've noticed one of the things that happened after any of those things, any of that competition, there is a moment of an exchange at the end of the competition. And that moment of exchange is in solidarity, and there's usually what we say colloquially is they dap, where they give a five to each other, they shake hands, and they hug. Well, that in and of itself is conflict, as a mechanism of conflict resolution. And that in and of itself is a mechanism that grows the understanding that peace doesn't necessarily come from a lack of competition. But it comes from a greater understanding of the reason that everyone is participating in the first place. And in that regard, spaces for example, diplomacy, public diplomacy, conflict mediation and resolution that affect institutions, that move institutions, can happen beyond or before claims. So the group doesn't necessarily need to have a claim to galvanize, just the notion that there are these cultural traditions and ways of interacting with each other that can be enviable, that could be modeled. One of those examples would be, and we'll get to this other question a little later and I'll go a little deeper into it, but the nature of democratization. The nature of opening the claims, so for example, we're not dealing with exclusive social institutions or exclusive government where people do not feel welcomed and embraced and the opportunity to grow. Well, we see that democratization happening, and I'll still refer back to this particular talent in this culture space, but let's open it up to slam poetry, for example. And I agree that poets are teachers. Slam poets, and this city has a great history of slam poetry. I know some of the folk who have been building those things, the platforms, but just consider the nature of the ability to find our voices, the ability to be able to present it in public, and the ability to sign up to do that because you want to, not because you had a special silver spoon or because you were someone's family member or you had an inside track. But just the platform of being able to say, I have something to say, artists in a community willing enough to recognize that, and you standing into the general public and they rate you. They rate you. They basically say if you're good or not. And that whole process is what we're, when we see the national, let's just look at the presidential season that's happening. There seems to be a lot of misunderstanding about the role of critique, about the role of constructive criticism, about the role of negotiation and moving. And so I think those are important models that come out of organic arts communities that could be replicated.
thank you, George. And that kind of leads me to the next question, and Julia, I'll go to that, and that is, what are the roles of the arts and arts education in readying people for democracy?
well, I think, as I grow older, I have less and less interest in black and white statements, that I adore gray areas. I think the gray areas where the best conversations occur. I think that many contemporary artists are very active citizens. They provide cultural and political commentary. But I think that's really only at its most effective when it's critical thinking rather than black and white thinking. Because black and white thinking is very limiting in any arena that you're interested in, not just the arts. So for me, when you think about the role of the arts, and again, I'm one who's often wary to assign arts a role because I think they're so diverse and so full of individual statements, but I'd say it's critical thinking, it's risk-taking, it's creativity, it's process, and I think process is huge because that's where you learn. I think it's about marathon thinking, not statements that are about this instance or about that person. And I think artists, also one of their talents, is a real comfort with naysayers and with discord, and that artists are able to move beyond that often and ask us the big questions that sometimes we're not ready to answer.
May I make something that Julie said really reminded me, struck me. I think you'll be amused by this. There was a time when the former French president Mitterrand was in a great combative mode with his economic ministers. And they weren't getting anywhere, and the public was restless. They wanted leadership. And each one of these guys apparently just kept quoting from their own theses, and then there was never any rapprochement. So Mitterrand had this idea. He says, all right, get these guys out of here. We're going to put them in the gallery, and I'm going to invite in the nation's best artists in all fields, and in painting and music and so forth, and I'm going to ask them to debate the economy. It's just what you said, you know. And apparently, it went on for 4 or 5 days, and it was vicious, bloody, and wonderful, full of laughter and joy, and you know all the kinds of things you expect from a group of French artists sitting in the parliament debating something that they talk about in the cafes anyway, in front of the president and in front of the economic ministers. I think we should try that.
Great idea.
Yeah, that's good. I have one thing to specifically add to that. This is a firsthand experience, and so I'd want to give you all this firsthand experience. As a cultural envoy for the State Department, I've traveled to over 15 countries into zones that were classified red, which would mean American citizens are not invited to go into those zones unless you have security clearance and or escorts. And so just consider the nature of this example. Honduras right now is the homicide capital of the hemisphere. And I was in Honduras during the coup, doing some work down there and a couple years back, and they had a major earthquake around that time period too. Now, currently, the United States Department of State is actively engaging in the urban arts into some of those communities where this question was specifically given to me to tackle, which was, how do we go into communities where there is no rule of law to grow the foundation so we can have democracy and growing democracy and those mechanisms? And the answer was, and I referred back to the answer from earlier, in some of the cultural traditions that we have, there are already rules and codes. In the arts community, there are codes and rules. And so before we, for example, give folks who do not have rule of law the nature of here's what elections look like, we give them the sense of there are codes to which to follow. One of those codes, for example, and this is something that you can all do your own survey for this in our city, one of those codes are produced murals, productions of murals, high art on walls, reduces graffiti vandalism. And it's one of those codes where we were trying to encourage young folk who lived in MS-13 communities, which is the worst gang in the hemisphere, in San Salvador, how to get them to, A, stop shooting each other, how to stop shooting law enforcement officials, and et cetera, right? But more importantly, how to grow the code of civility and humanity that is embedded in some of these art forms. And I think those are the ways that, in very raw approaches, we grow the seeds of democracy.
Okay, so we're going to open up for some questions from the audience. Before we do that, I love that statement, because we're going to read this our statement one more time and let you discuss for 1 minute and make another vote on the statement, whether you agree, you're neutral, or you disagree with the statement. And that is, music and art, more than anything else, are the most impactful means of enacting societal change. So talk amongst yourself and make one more vote, and we'll get back to you. Okay, I hate to cut everybody up. There's some great conversations going on at the tables. But if the person with the clicker can make a choice, A, B, or C, we're going to open it up for questions from all of you to our panelists. And if you could just raise your hand and please wait for the microphone, because this is being recorded for the radio.
Want to connect with that or not?
I could start. I have a. I'm not being too much of a panelist hog here. I have a question. So, one of the things you said, Mary, that sort of stuck with me, and there's an assumption that I've always lived with, and that is, if you're super cultured, then that if your culture somehow is inconsistent with or incompatible with those atrocious acts. And so, but if you think about this, what was going on in this country in the early 20th century with the eugenics movement, and you had really intelligent people like Oliver Wendell Holmes espousing this system of human classification. What do you do? What do you think about that?
My answer is probably going to appear very naive, but it wouldn't be the first time I'm accused of that particular state of being. I think if you have your beliefs in what is righteous and what is good and what is just, if you believe in art because of what art can be and how it inspires, I think you carry on. I think you just follow your heart and follow your mind. And I don't know what to do about people who are, I'll give another example. In the 1930s and 40s, there was a cleric on the radio, Father Coughlin, who openly and outwardly and nationally espoused anti-Semitism. And there was no mystery about that. There's a rather wonderful, horrible, but wonderful new book called FDR and the Jews by, I can't think of the names, two professors at American University. And they talk about the state of anti-Semitism in this country and how it just hovered and existed, but people carried on, and let's say, for want of a better term of naivete, we got past it. I don't know if I've answered your question.
Yes, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so I just have a question in general. So I'm a 25-year-old student studying international studies. I'm just kind of curious, I don't know, I like to ask, whenever I get the chance, where I can kind of make the most good and do the most good with myself. So I'm very, very privileged, young white male in America, the most privileged position maybe in the world right now. I have a lot of different options open to me. I can go a lot of different ways. And just always curious, like, should I go into the arts? I like writing poetry a bit. I like writing. Is that the place that I can do the most good? Should I go work for an NGO? There's so many different routes to take. I don't know if anyone wants to speak to what may be the best. I don't know. There's no best route, I know, but any thoughts on that in general? Because it's a big world out there, and I have no idea most of the time. So,
yeah, I have some thoughts on that. I was confronted often with those choices coming from a less privileged background and from a place where the definitive nature of those in front of me, parents and et cetera, would say, choose. So that's a luxury to feel that there is an option. But your awareness is good. But I was aware enough to know that those were false choices. And so I rejected the nature of a choice to, for example, would say, you know, don't pursue the art and go into the doctoral program. And I'm a university professor of political science for 16 some odd years already. And it turns out that my passions and my art, I brought with me, never leaving them, unapologetic, because I came from the perspective where if someone told me maybe I shouldn't do that, I thought to them, to myself, they weren't ready. I didn't think that I had a problem. I didn't think that the things that were interesting to me needed to be culled down. I didn't think I needed to be reined in, if you will. I thought to myself, sometimes these things, and one of the students that I've had, a former student of mine, told me, you know, your willingness to embrace those seemingly inconsistent things about you make up who you are in the first place. And so, you know, this direction versus that direction. And I brought it all to the point where I brought my culture into the classroom, built curriculum and classes around what I do, and have published on that work as well. And in fact, it's the culture that I brought with me that created this specific opportunity with the State Department that did not exist prior to the interaction. And so we see us as an artist, I see myself as a catalyst of change as well. And so the nature of going into a space, bringing everything we have, will change spaces inevitably over time. But when we don't bring it in with us, I think we limit what is potential.
Hi, I'm Lynn Corral. I've written poetry since I was a young person too. And I think what I want to know about is how self-expression can both help the inner world of conflict in ourselves, especially me as a woman and a person with a disability, and happens to be Jewish as well, and the outer world where we can express ourselves and be a force and maybe a very dangerous force for the world outside. Thank you.
I was talking to a gentleman at the table when we came in about the Arab Spring. He was talking about the current times in Egypt and the struggles with tourism, and I started thinking about all of the things that have come in terms of the arts out of the Arab Spring and the role of artists and that time in our history, which continues, and all of the art forms that either have seen an emergence or a restoration and a new celebration, everything from rap in Tunisia to protest songs in Yemen to Egyptian protest graffiti to poetry in Libya. And I think, you know, it's remarkable. Again, it's this story of hope and resilience. And I think those start as this individual, this ways that individuals are trying to find their own health and place and voice in a really difficult time. And I think through that becomes this collective movement and this hope.
Could I go back to the young man's question for a second? I wanted to think about it a minute before I said something. I would suspect that most of us in this room have been in that situation. I don't know that we all arrive at the point of firm decision at the same time. I think that there are people who studied music at age 5 and began to excel at age 11 and 12, and things began to happen for them at age 17, 18, and they don't know another path because they've always been in music, and that's where they get their joy, that's where they get their fulfillment. So there's no question to be asked at that time, with the exception of, you know, people who then have accidents and they can't use their hand in the same way, then they regroup. But if you have diverse interests, as you've expressed, and you're looking at diverse roads, and you're not sure which one to take, you're not ready. You're not ready to make that decision. But I would recommend that you keep an active interest in each of these. Keep pursuing each one as you can. You know, and I think in a year or two or three or four, whenever it happens, you'll find yourself maybe gravitating more to one side than the other. In other words, sometimes it's not the profession you choose, but the profession that comes after you and beckons you, that now's the time to. And in today's world, that could be a 5-year decision before you change your mind or before you combine professions, before you do something that hadn't been thought of before. Because right now you're asking very traditional questions in a world that's becoming more and more non-traditional. Because the people we hear about more and more are non-traditional. They're experimenting. I mean, it's the old, you know, build the first computer in the garage syndrome. Not that there's any pressure to do that, but I would say be patient with yourself, but keep pursuing all loves, you know, until it's time to go out and buy that engagement ring.
Thank you. I think this question has been underlying the entire conversation, but I would appreciate if the panelists would speak to this idea of power and shifting power and hegemony as a way of incorporating performance and art as a means of social change, and how grassroots organizing is a way that we shift that power dynamic.
A great question. And I'll stay within the frame, and it's not because I don't know how to talk about jazz or other things. Jazz was one of the first places of democratization because it gave the power for folks like Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, the opportunity to take what was the formal note structures and change it, do what they wanted to do. Monk would tell you that there was no wrong notes. Mm-hmm. So just to do that, and those were the folk who were also and the legacy that I've followed in the tradition of cultural envoy, Jazz Ambassadors was a program that was happening in the 60s as well as one of the opportunities to be able to promote the best face of American culture in a world that knew we weren't doing the best job internally. And so I've been one of those following in that legacy. And specifically as it relates to the idea of change and power. What is a cardboard box on a sidewalk? Well, depending on what block you walk down here, it could be housing. It could be just trash. But in the South Bronx, in 1973, in what would otherwise be a dire situation for all of the residents living there, a cardboard box on a sidewalk was an act of defiance and an act of empowerment to basically say, one, this is us, we live here, and this ground that you walk on, we will do something else with it. And what they did was created a dance floor. So I asked you earlier, I don't know how many folks have ever seen a breakdance battle, all that sort of stuff. Well, it happened when a group of young folk decided that killing, murder, drugs that was happening in their neighborhood wasn't theirs, wasn't for them. And so we can even go to COINTELPRO and start looking at the way that big institutions have played a role in beating down communities, if you will, but just the nature of the community saying, we will not have it any longer for ourselves, and we've got something to say, was the first wave of their empowerment. Transforming their sidewalk into a dance studio, transforming trains in New York City into moving canvases, which we're going to actually have some at the museum this year. There's going to be some urban art work. So just to see how that's transformed, started with the act that's saying, A, first, we have something to say. In my book, The Organic Globalizer, it defines this nature of these three steps of this political empowerment process. First, we've got something to say, and we will be heard. And the nature of artists to find that, the nature of young folk to find that. Okay, the second thing is after a given time, organizations coming out of the 70s and 80s started building social organizations, the nonprofits that were associated with the communities that were coming out of this urban art forms were growing. And we see that by rise of organizations like, for example, the Malcolm X grassroots movement nationally is one of the major organizations raising awareness to police brutality in inner cities, and they started doing the whole camera sort of stuff. So that was a group that grew out of the 80s, but out of the second wave of artists saying, you know, we got to do more than just do art, and we have to raise awareness. And now we're in the third stage now, where folks who would otherwise be related to these generations from the 70s on now are making claims on elections and electoral outcomes. And we see the rise of some of the last candidates, and there's one now, national candidate, who has incredible amount of attention from young folk, including the urban artists, who have galvanized around that. And so these are part of a legacy, but it starts off with saying, where we are is where we'll start, and we can transform our conditions by reimagining our spaces. And we see a lot of this in conversations of creative placemaking that are happening now in our city, what to do after the post-oil economy and that sort of stuff. But power starts with, let's redefine our space with even what we have.
Okay, one more question.
Hi there. So I have a question. I know the term artist is pretty intimidating for a lot of people. A lot of people are involved in art or have something of an imposter syndrome where you don't want to call yourself an artist or you don't feel comfortable calling yourself an artist. Where is room for non-artists or people who are hesitant to call themselves an artist in building community and political expression through arts?
I don't know that change is happening through people who self-identify. I think if you're creating, if you're using any form of expression, you can call yourself an artist or somebody else is going to call you an artist. But if you're exercising critical thinking and you're doing that in creative ways, you know, that's where change occurs. I think it comes from this elitist idea of what art can be, and that comes out of this commodification of art. I think the new way of thinking about contemporary art is much more about artists engaging in community, engaging in process. The new artist is the artist who does not create a product at all, but is engaged in social conversations, social action. I think we've seen a huge sea change in how we look at art in a contemporary world, which is a lot less to do with self-identifying with a term as much as being part of a process and a part of a conversation.
I think I could be a good example for that. There was a time when I felt saying that I was a conductor was a very pretentious way of announcing what I did. So I told people that I was interested in orchestral interpretive leadership. And the response was, huh?
You're a conductor.
Do you mean conductor? I said, well, I guess some people might define it that way. It took me a long time, because to me, conductors were like Toscanini, Leonard Bernstein, Herbert von Karajan. I mean, you know, I wasn't in that category. And I thought even to announce myself as somebody who was pursuing that path was really just not in my character, even though that was exactly what I was pursuing. And then I just saw it in print a few times and sort of got used to it. But I think you just do what you do, announce yourself as a painter, a sculptor, or, you know, someone who is a, you know, I work with whatever it is. And maybe it may, the very fact that you may be, how shall I say, intimidated about self-identification or self-representation in the arts in a specific way, it could very well be that the gestation period going on is that maybe you're angling for something that hasn't been defined yet, and maybe you're kind of searching. So I think if the first rule about being an artist is learn your craft, and then the second rule is choose your models very carefully, the people that inspire you. And most often they'll be traditional at first, and then you'll probably be gravitating to the more edgy people as life goes on, and therein lies the true responsibility, the true essence of your future. And I don't think you'll have any problem defining, you know, yourself after that. I'm not sure I answered your question, but
it's a great answer.
I would quickly add that that it's also about accessing the spirit of creativity. So regardless of how you define yourself, you can access this spirit. It's a big, powerful, beautiful, omnipresent spirit that anybody can access. One of the most comfortable times in my life was walking in Providence Hospital and noticing that it was called, this part of the hospital was called the Medical Arts Division. Now, or I'm always happy when my accountant is very creative, or my dentist is very creative, I'm very creative in my personal relationship. So I think it's about accessing this beautiful, powerful spirit, regardless of however you define yourself.
I agree 100% with that. Drop the labels. We access what we do, and we kind of live. We live in real time. And when we apply the creative beauty, I think we can be more inclusive with the nature of artistry by finding and encouraging that folks all have a degree of artistry, whether or not it's to be honed or crafted, but there are degrees of artistry to almost everyone, and making people feel comfortable with going on that process, I think, is one of the approaches that I've had with dealing with a lot of folk who will reject the term.
When you do your business cards, just put your name, email address, and watch this space.
And they'll get the point.
Well, I want to thank our panelists today, and I would encourage any of the young folks to come up and talk to them. These individuals have amazing careers and histories and paths, and each one of them can tell you their journey and the different things they did with their arts and their lives, and it's fascinating. So that would be a great conversation. So please come up and talk to them afterwards. We also have, thanks to the World Affairs Council Board of Directors, we'd like to give Murray a book on Alaska. I know he's here for the Defy Fear Week, and we are so thrilled to be part of that, and the concert chorus and your program. And so this is a book on Alaska, and we hope you come back again. And our other guests are from Alaska, so we're glad they're going to stay. And we have some World Affairs Council swag for them. And now the moment you're all waiting for, the results of our surveys. And so the question again, or the statement was, music and art, more than anything else, are the most impactful means of enacting societal change. And this was quite a shift. So before the conversation, 60% either disagreed with that or were neutral on that statement. And after the discussion, 60% agreed with it. So it was a complete switch for that. We will post this on our Facebook. You will also find on our Facebook, so join the conversation. If you want to be creative and be a blogger, please join our conversation and say something about this program, and you can see our surveys from our past ones. We are, like I said, a membership organization, so please consider becoming a member and fill out that card on your table or on your way out. And our next program that's coming up is in 2 weeks. We'll be back here with Dr. Steven Stedman from Stanford University, who's going to be speaking on managing global insecurity. So please join us for that conversation back here. And if you want to recycle your name tags, you can turn those in at the front desk. Thank you.